Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome. Welcome tonight. We're coming to you live tonight from western Idaho. Our Aki window forecast tonight, about 72 degrees. Just got done with a blustery thunderstorm. Not typical for Idaho. The solar wind tonight, 310.5 kilometers per second. And the proton count is so low, it doesn't even matter. About 1.5 protons. No sunspots and only a mild solar wind. If there is an aurora tonight, it won't come from the sun. On June 11th, researchers at NASA's Columbia Scientific Balloon Facility in Texas launched a telescope named EBEX. Its mission to measure the faint polarization of cosmic microwave background radiation, also known as CMBR. Linear polarization of the CMBR could prove that the large-scale structure of the universe today was cast by a tiny quantum fluctuation in space just a split second after the Big Bang. EBEX is probing the earliest moments of creation, also caused quite a stir among amateur astronomers as the balloon was a high-altitude balloon, silvery in appearance, and to the naked eye or to low-power binoculars may have looked like a UFO. Space Shuttle Endeavour, temporarily grounded by a hydrogen leak, should be ready to launch on June 17th, according to a Sunday evening announcement by NASA. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is currently scheduled to launch on that same date, so the moon mission could be bumped back to June 19th or 20th. The situation will sort itself out in the next 24 to 48 hours as repairs on the Endeavour proceed. The cloudy, chilly, and rainy open to June in Chicago has been the talk of the town. So far this June is running more than 12 degrees cooler than last year, and the clouds, rain, and chilly lake winds have been persistent. The average temperature at O'Hare National Airport through Friday has been only 59.5 degrees, nearly 7 degrees below normal, and the coldest since records there began 50 years ago. If you'll remember, last week we had record cold weather for New York with frost warnings. If you fly over the planet, as I have done for the last month, you will notice that you cannot see the ground. Cloud covers about 75% of the northern hemisphere. This blocks the sun from warming the ground. Read the second volume of The Ark of Millions of Years and you'll know what is coming. We recommend you better pack some supplies for this winter. And if you're interested in putting together an emergency preparedness pack, 72 hours or a year's supply of that kind of stuff that would last without you having to rotate it on a regular basis. Why don't you click on the Nitro Pack banner at X Squared Radio? Just check it out. There's no obligation. Just check on there. Go in. You'll see that everything that you need or could think about is there. And one of the nice things about Nitro Pack is hopefully you will never need anything that they sell there, but I can tell you survival is made so much easier when you have the right stuff. I won't say that it's comfortable, but you won't be fearing for your life or for how to get through the next day. If you just have the basics, clean water, some decent food to eat, a simple change of clothes, those kinds of things. And who knows, you might need to leave the area for a while, a la New Orleans after Katrina hit. Also, this week, starting tomorrow, if you happen to be traveling to Paris, look up, because it's an International Paris Air Show. One of the coolest things about the Paris Air Show is the incredible show of military hardware. Now, I am a pacifist. Those of you who know me know this, but I'm also fascinated by air travel. It is a sad commentary that the best flying machines happen to be employed by the military. Mostly that's because a lot of the research and development is along the lines of trial and error. And the only companies that can really afford trial and error are backed by the federal government. Automotive industry, we call this a bailout, but in military projects, it's often called black funding. So, if you get a chance, make your way over to the Paris Air Show or pull it up on the internet after it happens. It's the 15th through the 17th of this week. And check out some of the new stuff that's being flown around. Bernoulli would be amazed. Those of you who don't know Bernoulli, Bernoulli's principle is the differential pressure generated by the wing. It's his theory that makes flight possible for all flying things, except that is, of course, the bee. Not supposed to fly the bee, according to Bernoulli. Also coming up this week is the H2O Live concert. Now, if you're worried about being close to it, don't, because it's in 26 different cities around the world. However, that being said, there have been, I won't say logistical problems, I will say that they are event planning problems. Putting on a concert in one venue is difficult enough, but putting it on in 26 different venues is prohibitively complex, and evidently what has happened is access to the water, being that this is an H2O live concert, the idea that the patrons, that is to say the people coming to the concert, could all hold hands and sing songs tuned to the frequency of 528 hertz near the water. And being that it's in June and most of the northern hemisphere would be able to do so ankles deep in it. But unfortunately, the access to permits were not taken care of far enough advance. And so most of the beaches will not be accessible, and the concerts will be held in much smaller venues. For instance, in Vancouver, the venue can barely hold about 1,000 people. The event will only last 3 hours. However, I still recommend going, because all of the revenues taken in will just help it gain momentum for next year. And being that it is one of the largest earth healing events ever attempted, and our good friend Leonard Horowitz is sponsoring this, putting it on, came up with the idea, I recommend that you get down there and support it with everything you've got. Just go down, have a good time, and be generous. In space news, there are some pretty cool things happening. I thought I would go ahead and add those at the front end of the program tonight. X Squared Radio, by the way, is a 3-hour program. And so we invite telephone calls all night long. Tonight we do not have a guest. That is to say, you are the guest. And we welcome you anytime you want to call in. But sometimes we do have a guest and we don't take that many callers. But tonight, because there are so many very neat things happening in the world, we wanted to go ahead and leave the lines open all night. U.S. and Canada toll free anywhere, 888-228-4494. And if you've got free nights and weekends, as most people do who carry a cell phone around these days, if you can reach a cell phone tower on planet, off planet, if you can get to one, you can get to us. 530-776-5154. We also take Skype. Just use BBS Radio as your contact. And we even take PalTalk. So if you're using that, it's BBSRadio_com. We aim to accommodate those who are trying to reach us. And it's important to us because without you, we would not exist. And so we try to leave the phone lines open whenever we can. Tonight, they're open all night. Called Power Cubed, the system uses an asymmetric capacitor to charge ion particles around an object. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this, just think back to the Philadelphia Project. This was a Tesla experiment where a ship was covered in ions generated by turbine generators. And ostensibly what happened is the ship flat disappeared and then reappeared, leaving some of the crew caught halfway between bulkheads, and the rest was some kind of mental instability the rest of their lives. Electron movement between these particles generates force, moving the object in the direction desired. So this is a propulsion system. The system tested before the public for the first time on June 20th, 2001, that was 8 years ago, has been the pet project of Transdimensional's founder, Jeffrey Cameron, for most of his professional career. Quote, "The Army is looking into Power Cubed as a way to make its tanks lighter," Preston says, "and we're hoping NASA may consider it for its next generation of X-Series space shuttle replacements. Aerospace vehicles could use conventional thrust to get themselves into orbit or high altitude, then use Power Cubed to cruise, like the Honda Insight does with gas and electricity. Although we hope it gets considerably better mileage than the Insight." The interesting thing about this technology is that we are beginning to think outside the strap a man to a bomb mentality and different ways of moving through space. Now, obviously, if we're doing something other than expanding gas out a nozzle of the back end, trying to get velocities up, then we're going to be able to cut distances, and thus time will come apart for us. NASA is putting money into momentum exchange electrodynamic reboost tether technology, MIXER for short. It's kind of a long acronym, okay? So let me explain it to you. It's a little like a medieval siege device, so hear me out. It's an innovative concept that, if implemented, could station miles and miles of cartwheeling cable in orbit around the Earth, and then, rotating like a giant sling, the cable would swoop down and pick up spacecraft in low orbits, then hurl them to higher orbits, or even lob them onward to other planets. Kind of like slingshotting around the moon to gain momentum, or around Jupiter to gain momentum to go deeper into space. Only this does it sort of like a giant crack of the whip. The MIXER tether system will serve as a fully reusable transportation hub in orbit. It's sort of like a space railroad, said Robert Hoyt, president and chief scientist for Tethers Unlimited, Inc., Science Ops. TUI was awarded funds to look into a mixer tether system based on deployment of a 62-mile-long cable in orbit around the Earth. Universities like Tennessee Technological University happens to be my old alma mater. I graduated from Tennessee Tech. Are involved, so we're confident, but it's sort of like a 100-kilometer-long fishnet stocking in space, only it's incredibly strong and it can withstand many years of bombardment by orbital debris, Hoyle says. Now, what I'd like to point out here, because a lot of times people do not gather information from one experiment to the next, and oftentimes experiments don't work out the way we think they will. And in other words, they fail. And we learn something from the failure, like don't do that again. What we want to point out here is the result of the space dynamo experiment. This was with approximately 20-mile long tether that was dragged behind the shuttle to see if there was any voltage that could be measured as the tether moved through the magnetosphere. Those of you that don't know what a dynamo is, it was employed almost universally in the 30s in motor technology and generator technology. We now commonly use it in alternators in our vehicles. But basically, it means that you can move a wire through a field of moving ions or a magnetic field, and it will induce a current flow. In the dynamo idea, you can actually string a wire across a river, letting the water of the river pass over the wire. And the movement of ions perpendicular to the wire in the water would induce a current flow. Now, it's believed that some of this is induction and some of this is actually ions jumping on the wire and then kinetically moving to either end of the wire, sort of like extra passengers on a train, making it more crowded, and thus everything moves to the ends of the train, and lo and behold, ions pop off the end, hence current flow. Anyway, a few minutes after the experiment began, the tether exploded. The voltage gathered was so high that the super strong filament literally blew up. And they estimated it would have taken a couple of million volts for this to happen, but that's exactly what did happen. Sort of like dragging a giant extension cord out the back of the shuttle to see if it would gather current flow from raw space. It most certainly did. And what we want to make sure is that the folks at Mixer are sure that the magnetically induced power will not be an issue with the tether launcher. It would be rather unfortunate for that 62-mile-long tether to gather up a huge current flow and right at the moment of cracking the whip and launching that half-billion-dollar satellite out into orbit, it would explode, like being at the end of a rather nasty lightning bolt. Just checking. Just wanted to make sure that they had that in mind. So if you're out there working on the Mixer project and you're listening to X Squared Radio tonight, make a note. Just put it on that note and put it behind the refrigerator magnet and pick it up on your way out in the morning and check it out. That's all we're asking. Tonight, I would like to bring you up to date on several things that are in the news and several things that are happening with respect to green technologies out there. You might know just by watching the news or listening to various prognosticators out there that the Obama administration has shown some aggression toward funding green technologies. Excuse me while I pour some water down my neck. We were watching for that ourselves in our private endeavors, as the Department of Energy has not been too awful aggressive over the last 10 years, occasionally coming up with a good program like the Energy Freedom Act, if it was not for for President Bush's Energy Freedom Act, the biodiesel industry would have all but come to a complete stop. However, that was really not that much money, about $10 million per state, not really enough to get anything going. And keep in mind, these programs are not bailout programs, not by any means. These programs require an equity match by the recipients. In many cases, it's dollar for dollar. It's a 50% match. That is to say, if your project costs $10 million, you must raise $5 million, and then the government will kick in $5 million. So it's, you know, by no means a slam dunk, and it's not a giveaway program. However, that being said, it does take quite the edge off of funding things and getting risky or unknown technologies to the forefront. And so the news media can play a very important role in getting the right news to you, the truth to you. Now, that's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? News and truth doesn't seem to go together anymore. But that being said, there's a certain amount of hype that goes into the news, and that's being rather cynical about it, actually, because I think the reality is there is often a lot of hype that goes into the news. One of those subjects is the subject of global warming, served back and forth faster than a tennis ball. We see some of the scientific community saying a global warming is a reality. How can you possibly deny the facts right before your eyes? And other scientists in the same community, although on the other side of the imaginary aisle, are saying these are normal vacillations in planetary temperatures, and planets have a way of correcting themselves, and you know, we really don't have enough perspective, even if we've been looking at things for 200 years. That's a cosmic microsecond, and we really don't have enough empirical data, they call it, to draw conclusions. That being said, the downside of both points of view differ quite dramatically. For instance, if the downside of those who say global warming is a terrible thing and really we are the cause of it and we need to correct the way that we interact with our planet, the way we use our resources of our planet, or we're going to extinct ourselves and everyone, every other form of life except maybe the cockroach, if they're wrong, then the downside's really not so bad. Oh, we might have spent a little money and we might have started a few companies that self-attrit when things self-correct. So what? I mean, that's the nature of you know, crying wolf. However, the downside, if global warming really is happening and we really do have enough impact that correcting our activities now, or even, shall we say, 10 years ago, we might be beyond the point of no return now, but correcting our activities now might be just the tenth of a degree that the planet needs not to go over the edge. not to go into thermal runaway and, you know, reach a threshold where some particularly nasty reservoirs of greenhouse gases are stored and would thus be released, making our atmosphere virtually unbreathable. In case you didn't know about that, I'll just bring you up to date on that. Deep in the ocean, where pressures are extreme and temperatures are low, is an ocean of methane, liquid methane, under pressure and cold enough to stay liquid, and cold enough and dense enough not to go into solution with seawater. That being said, here you have this wonderful organic compound, you know, above the methane. Methane is NH3. That's nitrogen with three hydrogens on it. And I'm sorry, it's ammonia. Methane is one carbon, three hydrogens, or four hydrogens. CH4 can exist in both forms. So you have this wonderful organic solvent sitting on the bottom of the ocean in liquid form, and it will turn to gas in normal atmospheric conditions. That is to say, one atmosphere around 20 degrees C, that kind of thing, methane goes into gaseous state. And that's not the kind of thing that you want in your atmosphere. It's a very powerful greenhouse gas. It is also flammable in alcohol form. It is also poisonous to humans. So a rather large ocean of it sits on the bottom of the sea. The sea, being nice and cold and offering lots of pressure, keeps that in check. However, as the sea warms up, the amount of pressure that it takes to keep this methane in liquid form goes up, and the ocean cannot deliver any more pressure, and so therefore the methane begins to bubble to the surface. Does it happen? Yes, of course it does. Many, many, many aircraft have fallen out of the sky and crashed into the ocean in a matter of seconds over the Bermuda Triangle. Now, admittedly, most of these are flying at low altitude, 2,000 feet or less. Some of them 500 feet off the water, zipping out there in certain military missions, and have inadvertently flown into a cloud of methane. Now, keep in mind, this cloud only needs to be about 1.5% concentration of methane. But once the plane flies into that cloud, the lift required to keep the plane in the air, the lift dynamics change. Normal aircraft flying along at, say, 200 miles an hour, perfectly floating along in air, would no longer float at that speed in methane. Not to mention, the engine would quit running, especially diesel engines. Once the engine, requiring a certain amount of oxygen to complete combustion, the oxygen is displaced by the methane, the engine dies, the forward velocity goes away, and the craft, unable to do much more than get its landing gear and half flaps deployed, smacks into the ocean without so much as a warning. And that's been proven time and time again that's exactly what happens. Also, what changes is the buoyancy of water. Yes, that's absolutely right. So methane bubbles perforating and coming up through seawater make the seawater less buoyant. And so you know how ships are calculated to float. The hull has to displace more water than the ship weighs, and so therefore the ship can float. As long as the ship can displace that amount of water, then the ship stays above the surface. But if the buoyancy of the water changes, then those formulas change. And if the ship is on the borderline, like say would be an oil supertanker chugging along at 7 knots, or some kind of freighter that's deep in the water, would easily sink beneath the sea, and if the hatches were not battened down, would flood and sink right to the bottom in just a few minutes. So there are changes that occur because this liquid methane goes into gaseous state unpredictably. And certainly the temperature of the Earth has an effect on whether that methane stays in liquid form or not. So there's significant downside if global warming is real. And not so much downside if they're hollering and we invest a lot of money and we clean up our planet and nothing happens. It's a little bit different than Y2K. Remember in Y2K we were upset because the binary code of chips was such that it just couldn't handle the year 2000. We could go 1999, but we couldn't go 2000. And so a lot of money was spent for absolutely nothing. It was kind of a joke. But global warming is a little bit different. And there are some unknowns that may exacerbate things. One of those is the idea of a pole shift. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what a pole shift is, this is where the North and South Poles reverse. There is evidence that this has occurred in the past on the Earth. It's recorded in the geological record. There are some ancient legends, and by ancient I mean going back like 25,000 years, where the sun used to rise in the west and set in the east, and the Nile River flowed south. But you can't put a whole lot of stock in historical records. People, societies can just get up on the wrong side of the bed one day and the king, you know, decides this is the way it's going to be, and all other records of anything else will be expunged from existence. And so that's what you have. But the geological record cannot be faked. It can't be explained away. That being said, geologists and planetary geologists and even cosmologists wonder from time to time, could it happen again? As you know, every solar cycle, every time we reach a solar maximum, the sun reverses polarity. That is to say, the north becomes south and the south becomes north. A lot of you didn't know that. Well, Earth does that too from time to time. We don't really worry about flora and fauna and the migratory pattern of bees on the sun. But we do worry about these kinds of things on the Earth. And significant changes could happen with just very minor shifts in that kind of relationship here on the Earth. For instance, right now, as a result of stronger winds caused by global warming, seeds and pollen are being carried over longer distances. Now, one of the impacts of this proliferation is the following insect population that lives off these plants, and also more complex life forms, even bacteria that live off these plants as well. Let me give you an example. Global warming is moving the warm line further north each year. Armadillos are now commonly seen in Tennessee, which would have been unthinkable just 20 years ago. And even fire ants are moving north into Tennessee. These are the kinds of things commonly seen in Texas and maybe Arkansas, but certainly not Tennessee. and moving on up into Kentucky. The armadillo moving north does change the balance of ecology, competing with wonderful indigenous life forms like the possum. Armadillo is just kind of an armored possum, lives off almost the same thing, and like a marsupial. So global warming does have some evidence out there, and exacerbated by a pole shift could be rather dramatic. Now, that being said, I don't think the activities of man have anything to do with a pole shift. We'll cover that a little bit more in the second hour. I do want to go more into pole shifting. And one of the main reasons that I want to cover that tonight is because this year, the folks that brought us the Horizon Project, the folks at Intuitive Design, are reshooting the Horizon Project. They have evidently sold enough of that, and it's actually a very fine production. It's very well done, and it delivers a punch right between the eyes, a wake-up call for any who have seen that film. And the Horizon Project, if you're interested in it, the banner is still up at X Squared Radio. You can certainly click on that and get that film anytime you like and look at it. But it is now being reshot. That is to say, there's enough new evidence and enough of the scientific community now listening to what we have been saying for about 4 years, that it commands a second performance, so to speak. And so the Horizon Project is going to be reshot, and the idea of a pole shift, a polar shift, is going to be revisited. But I do want to cover this subject of global warming a little more thoroughly. We have about 17 minutes left in this hour. I want to make sure that you know that the phone lines are open for those of you that just joined us. This is X Squared Radio, a three-hour radio program. We talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth here. The reason it's called X Squared Radio is because we try to cover everything from a positive standpoint. We do not do conspiracy theories. We don't do ghosts or goblins or anything like that here. We sort of take the higher scientific echelon road, and those of you that want to participate in that can certainly do so by calling toll-free 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494, or if you have free nights and weekends or live close to a cell phone tower, if you can get to a cell phone tower on planet, off planet, and it doesn't matter to us, you'll be able to get to us. It's 530-776-5154. We have a caller on line one. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, Brooks. This is Barry in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Barry. Welcome to the program.
Why, thank you. You made mention of pole shifts on the sun, and I was just curious if you have given any thought to the behavior of the most recent shift, what, about 8 years ago or something, where the magnetic fields became bifurcated, where the the North Pole effectively went towards the center. And I'm sorry, it'd be the South Pole effectively went towards the center, and there were two North Poles effectively on the sun.
Thing that's happening because of that, normally we punctuate solar cycles by the appearance of what are called high-latitude reverse polarized sunspots. These are telltale signs that we're entering a new solar cycle. We're supposed to be well into solar cycle 24 now. But we are going long, long periods with no sunspots at all. However, we're seeing quite a few filaments, and these filaments are, just like you said, they are caused by a dual north pole ripping at the center of the sun.
Effectively, what is that implied towards the solar winds?
Well, it doesn't affect the solar winds so much. We attribute solar
the velocity is quite low.
It has been low for a long time. We normally get solar winds from coronal holes, or even from CMEs, these coronal mass ejection. But the filaments are much more insidious in the sense that they're not exactly sunspots, circular areas of magnetic disturbance. Filaments are more like a tear, more like a ribbon of magnetic instability. And when they snap apart, they can cause huge solar flares. And the solar flares, especially when they get up in the X class, these are ones that have extremely high energy protons that come whipping out of the corona, and if they're pointed toward Earth, or worse, they're pointed toward the geosynchronous satellites around Earth, they can play havoc with electronics big time.
But we haven't seen any of that. That originates from the photosphere.
No, it originates either from sunspots or from these filaments. Now, occasionally, you know, CMEs can just happen. But normally, when we watch these filaments, if they collapse, they can create, you know, an ejection, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles out into space, and it's really high velocity.
I see. Okay, just thought I'd throw that out, and I appreciate the comment.
Hey, no problem. I'm not a solar scientist, but we try to keep up with that stuff. We report on the solar wind every night when we start the program here on Sunday nights.
Okay. Okay.
Most people don't pay any attention to it, but if they track it over time, then they realize that, hey, we're getting up around 700 or 800 kilometers per second. We're in a pretty aggressive stream from the sun.
Really? See, I just go to spaceweather.com and I see that it's solar winds are like 300 kilometers per second, which is
right.
Just below
so
escape velocity of 400.
310.5.
Yeah. So I just kind of, I don't know.
Well, if they get up to about 700, we almost always begin to have a geomagnetic disturbance here on the Earth.
Yeah, I'd like to see that, you know. Hopefully, there's definitely a correlation between that and the economy. But, okay, appreciate your show. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. I want to make sure that you know you can reach us 530-776-5154. The thing about the pole shift on the Earth is it doesn't happen very often. And when it does happen, it can happen in rather short order. It does not take years for the poles to shift. It can shift in a matter of days. And in our next hour, we'll talk about some of the ramifications of a pole shift. Some people say, well, so what? You know, my compass will read a little bit different. Everything will be just fine. Planet's not going to change. My job's not going to change. People are still going to buy cheeseburgers, blah, blah, blah. But I can tell you there are some very profound changes that we haven't thought about in a while. And so we're going to discuss them on the program in the next hour. And the other thing that we're going to discuss is peak oil. Those of you that have been watching the news notice oil is back up to $73 a barrel. There are economic reasons for that happening. It is not just the demand of China and the demand of India on oil. Although that does have an effect, it is more the economics of the oil providers, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, they are more concerned with the revenues of their countries than they are with the disposable dollars of Americans. I can tell you, I've been to those countries, and that is their attitude. And I can also tell you that the economics of those countries demand that oil be around $70 a barrel as a minimum threshold for them. So if you're crying because oil or your gas is back up to $2.85 or $2.95 a gallon, you haven't seen anything yet. And I'm not telling you to start banking money to buy gasoline, or you don't even need to go out and sell your Cadillac Escalade. But there are things that you can do, because very soon Global Green Cars is going into mass production, not just the 100 cars per month, but more like 2,800 cars a month to get their electric trucks and electric cars. And these are plug-in electric vehicles. Some of them are plug-in hybrids, but they're not hybrids like you're used to seeing. No. These aren't the ones that you just keep pouring gas in and you just keep driving and driving and driving and driving long after the battery is exhausted. These have a finite range. That range is well above 100 miles between charges. These plug-in hybrids approach the hybrid technology from a little different standpoint. It is a patented standpoint, and I can tell you that mileages of over 140 miles per gallon are commonplace with these cars. Yes, they are fast. They'll go 100 miles an hour. Yes, they'll lay 50 feet of rubber if that's what you want to do. In the meantime, they will get you back and forth to work every single day, reliably for years and years and years without a single drop of gasoline, if that's your desire. If you want to put gas in the little 1 or 2 gallon tank, then you can extend your mileage out there 20 or 30 miles and take care of almost any kind of driving you want to do except the cross-country driving. In the 90s, when Global Green Cars was in full production of electric vehicles and competed in the EV America Challenge, which was put on by the federal government, their production vehicles, when sold to consumers who already had one or two cars and promised that the electric car would just be a second car or a third car in their families, the electric car quickly became the primary car. All of the soccer games and school trips and to and from work, to and from grocery, to and from the movies, every single in-town trip all week long was done with the electric car. And it was the gasoline car that became the second car. When you needed to go between Salt Lake and St. George, or you needed to go between Los Angeles and Pasadena, there and back in a couple of hours, then you got the gasoline vehicle out. But when you were just driving from the valley to downtown, working there all day and then driving from downtown back out to the valley in 25 mile per hour traffic, the electric car got all the use. It was the electric car that that made everyone happy. And if it wasn't for the political aspirations of Pete Wilson killing the California mandates, which by now would have generated a significant commuter fleet being electric, something like 1 or 2 million automobiles would have been electric by now, you would have seen them. But those political aspirations, of course, killed the mandates in 1998. Gasoline was $1.05 a gallon, and that was the end of that. Now gasoline's back up, and now the consumer is really wanting to have that electric car. I'm going to read an article to you. It came out in the Times Tribune. Actually, it was above and below the fold, but I'm not going to read you the article about the car itself. That's kind of academic. The writer herself, her name is Ivy Brashear. She's a staff writer for the for the Times Tribune, wrote a very interesting article. I have not seen an article like this with respect to global green cars before. I'm going to read it to you. She says, "I've always wanted to be a writer. Even when I was a little girl, I would write stories about fantastic adventures. And as I grew up, I found that I loved to tell other people's stories as a journalist so that we could all find common ground in this very uneven world. But I have a secret. There is something else at which I've always thought I would be excellent. I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but I would love to be a race car driver. I know, you're thinking immediately that I'm lying through my teeth about this. You might even imagine a mullet and a farmer's tan with a beer cooler in tow. Well, I might have the farmer's tan," she says. Allow me to go to page 2. But the mullet can be saved for other people more brave than I and better equipped to pull it off. No, I don't fit the stereotype, but I do like to drive fast. Don't tell my mother this, but I'm a self-proclaimed speeder. And you might, on occasion, if you are brave enough to ride in the passenger side with me, see me grip the wheel white-knuckled and make a slight revving noise here and there. So when my editor, Samantha Swindler, told me that Global Green Cars, Inc. was test-driving one of their electric cars at the Corbin Speedway, this is in Kentucky, in anticipation of a brand-new plant they planned to build in Williamsburg, I jumped at the chance to drive that car around the track. It would fulfill my secret dream. How could I pass it up? Also, I drive a hybrid car myself, and I was curious as to how a totally electric car would compare to my own. Arriving at the track, I expected to see a prototype fit for the finest Detroit auto show with shiny new paint and a fancy dash panel display. And what I got was a 15-year-old Geo Metro with batteries for a back seat and not even a radio to blast as I drove Mario Andretti style around the track. I was skeptical of this car's performance. Will it drive faster than a golf cart? Will I be able to take these turns quickly? Will I even make it around the track without the battery dying? Well, the president of Global Green Cars assured me that this car could perform at the highest standards set by the motor vehicle industry. I heard about an actual race car driver taking some laps in this car earlier, who said the Geo performed at the same level as his race car. I heard about how the little Geo had more stopping power than gasoline-powered cars its size category, and how it could drive over 100 miles per hour if you really wanted to. I was beginning to believe in the electric car. I asked how the car was charged. The gas tank was opened, where I expected to see a gas tank cover. There was the end of what looked like an ordinary extension cord. If you plug it into your garage overnight, and when you wake up in the morning, the car is ready to be driven to and from work and all over town. Well, I don't know if the wow I actually felt came out of my mouth or not, but then he told me to hop in and drive. The moment of truth, I thought. And also my moment to become that race car driver I've always secretly wished to be. I sat down in the car and was ready to put the key in the ignition, but when I looked down, I saw it was already there. I couldn't hear a thing. I thought the car was off. "It is started," I asked, as he stood outside the car. The driver sighed. There was no engine noise, no gentle rumble of an idling car. I was taken aback. He confirmed that the car was on and told me that I'm not the only one surprised by the lack of noise the car makes. He said people have even asked for a mixed CD of engine sounds to play while they're driving the car, a driver's security blanket of sorts. I took the brake off and pressed what would normally be the gas. It was like driving in a vacuum. with the only sound being the wheels on the pavement. It was surreal almost not hearing the sounds of gasoline-powered cars makes. The shifting gears, the revving engine, it sounded like a golf cart, but it drove as good as my hybrid and as good as a car that guzzles gasoline. There was no doubt about the electric car's performance, especially after my inner Dale Earnhardt came out and I punched the gas so I could finally find out what it's like to be a race car driver. I wasn't disappointed, even if I still had to make the revving sounds. Interesting article in the Times Tribune about the electric car about to go into production in eastern Kentucky. If you want to know more about that, all you really have to do is just pick up the news and read about it yourself, or Google it, Global Green Cars. And we'll be back after these messages. Just chill with some music. If you're listening through an affiliate, you're probably going to get some commercials. We'll be back at about 3 minutes. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming up. Back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from western Idaho. AccuWindow forecast, clear skies, about 73 degrees. A little bit below normal. Normally it's about 200 degrees outside. And dry as a bone. But it's been raining most of the day. If you own an inkjet printer, as I do, I own a couple of them. You can buy them pretty cheaply now. But those darn consumables, man. Go to buy an inkjet cartridge for those things. It can be expensive, but not anymore. All you really have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you can pick up inkjet cartridges, consumables, even for laser printers, toner, all kinds of stuff, for amazingly cheap prices. Some of these inkjet cartridges can run you, oh gosh, $80 if you want to replace both of them at your local superstore. But at 123 Inkjets, you can pick up the same stuff for about $15 a cartridge. And most of the time you get free shipping. And the neat thing is every time you order, you get a free opportunity to buy or to win a free printer. Now that's pretty cool. So check them out. 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. Also, you college students, or better yet, parents who have students in college, those textbooks are pretty expensive, but there's a company that's come out with a brand new business plan that's just amazing. It's phenomenal. It's gonna sweep the country. It's called Campus Book Rentals. And if you'll click on the Campus Book Rentals banner at X Squared Radio, you might be able to rent that textbook for a semester, greatly cutting your costs. Instead of spending $100 or $200 to buy that textbook, you can rent it. Just like renting a movie, and when you're done with it, you turn it back in, and you don't have to worry about taking a bath, trying to get rid of used books. Really a neat idea. I liked it. And don't forget, June 19th through 21st, coming up very quickly here, the H2O Live concert. If you'll click on that banner, you can learn all about it. Leonard Horowitz putting on the H2O Live concerts, 26 different venues around the country, billed as the largest earth healing event in the world. And those of you who are trying to figure out which conference to go to this summer, if you're not going to make it to the H2O Live concert, or even if you are going to make it to the H2O Live concert, there's another one you need to consider. If you have never made it, you need to go. If you've gone before, you need to go again. And that is the Earth Transformation Conference coming up. It is the weekend of July 4th. It is in Trout Lake, Washington. The website is eceti.org, E-C-E-T-I.org. Check it out. Bring a tent, your sleeping bag. Sleep in an echinacea field beneath the stars at the foot of Mount Adams and learn what a UFO really is. If you've never seen one, bring your camera, because I can almost guarantee you're going to see something out of the ordinary in Trout Lake. James Gilliland is the person putting it on. I'll be there, and if you want to come up and meet, it's no problem. My table will be right there in the meeting hall, and usually go a day early and leave a day late just to make sure I don't miss anything. It is July 4th weekend, eceti.org. And don't go away, because we will be right back with X Squared Radio. Hour 2 of X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive, and we study the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Our phone lines are open all night tonight. If you want to call toll-free, no problem. 888-228-4494. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. The number is 530-776-5154. It's important that you give it a try. If you've never called in before, we would love to hear from you. We love to hear from people who have never called in before. If you're a regular call in, realize we weren't here last week. I don't know what played, honestly. We had some kind of archive play. I was on the road dragging the electric car prototype from Kentucky back up here to Idaho. We have a lot going on with this program, people. Electric cars are about to become a regular thing. You'll be able to find it at your dealership. We are in the process of adding dealerships. If you own a dealership and you listen to this program, give us a call. The website is ggci-us.com. Right now there's just an intro page up there, but that is because we're kind of flying below the radar right now. We're not really interested in getting a lot of publicity because it doesn't do us much good right now. So we're just trying to pay attention and stay out of the news and trying to get everything together that we can to make sure that you guys get your electric car without anybody standing in the way. And right now, no news is good news. So hang in there, but if you want to check on the website, check us out at ggci-us.com. So this is the second hour of X Squared Radio, and we're going to go into a little more depth on pole shift. How it could happen, how fast it could happen, what are the effects that will happen on the Earth, and where you can find out more. How can you prepare for it? I mean, gee, what do? You get an amazing shift like this occurring, and is it like an earthquake where you have to jump up in the air and stay there, or is it something that you know, that you can survive? It's hard to tell. But what we're going to do is we'll cover that right now. The most important thing to realize is that the pole shift can occur very quickly. It doesn't take months or even years for it to occur. It can actually happen it can happen in just a few days. Within 2 or 3 days, the poles could shift, and everything could change. That is to say, the Gulf Stream would move out of its path, moving sea life away from the coasts and those things that we rely on to feed our nations, like plankton and small fish like mackerel and tuna and things like that, would probably drift far out to sea with the Gulf Stream. The jet stream would move, which would definitely move weather around. And that could have a devastating effect on rain patterns for crops and filling up lakes and reservoirs to supply cities with water. The patterns of insects and birds would change because it is thought that their internal guidance systems are hooked into the magnetism of the Earth. If that's the case, then bees and birds and all kinds of things that are responsible for pollinating plants and moving seeds around the planet would change, which would change the face of our planet. Deserts might become tropical again, and tropical areas might become deserts again, not to mention the stress that could occur on the Earth itself. Mountains can come shooting up out of valleys, and valleys can collapse even further. If you fly over this country, one of the things that you'll notice as you look down out that window is the presence or the lack of presence of large bodies of water that were once on this continent. We're talking giant lakes or giant seas even that were there. You could see the deposits of sand. You could see the ripples in the mountains and in the low hills where the water once resided. Where did that water go? Did it evaporate, or did the earth crack open and it fell into a deep crevice under the earth? Well, these are the kinds of events that would accompany a pole shift. The stress on the crust itself could be cataclysmic. Now, that being said, from a planetary geological point of view, how could a pole shift occur? I mean, do the magnetic lines just switch around on the planet? What actually moves? Does the Earth roll over on itself where it slows to a stop and then starts rotating in the other direction? Probably not. Probably what occurs is that the relationship between the core and the crust changes. It's called the Coriolis effect. It does occur in gyroscopes. It might be how planets change their poles. It's hard to tell. But if we are an expanded planet, a planet that was once one-third its present size, then it makes sense that there's some kind of void between the core and the crust. That being said, as the crust expands and cools, it also slows in order to conserve momentum and satisfy that equation. So that means that the crust is rotating somewhat slower than the core. That counter-rotation is what causes the magnetosphere. The magnetosphere is a very powerful magnetic field, very stable, but it's kind of quasi-stable, sort of ebbs and flows like an amoeba at the poles. But for all intents and purposes, it's pretty stable. Flux lines come out of the north of our planet, travel around the planet, and go back into the south end of our planet, just like they would in a regular bar magnet with a north and a south pole. The flux lines are unbroken and travel continuously with no interruption. That being said, the reverse flow of that magnetism is going to change the voltage of the Earth. It's going to change the magnetism of the Earth. And it might even change or certainly affect the relationship of the human transducer, that's the human body, with the Earth. And that's pretty interesting. We could be faced with anxiety. We could be faced with disorientation, just like bees, just like birds, just like any other animal. Does that mean we'll not be able to follow the highway to work and back? Hard to say. But it might mean we'd be hard-pressed to negotiate our day. And that could have devastating effect on the Earth. We do rely upon certain world leaders to maintain their stability, especially their mental stability. And hopefully they don't push any buttons too soon or too late or at the wrong time or for silly reasons like I don't feel good today, let's just end this. And hopefully all of that will continue the way it has always continued. But the pole shift does seem to be almost inevitable, and so that being said, we should kind of make ourselves familiar with it so that when it happens, when they announce it on the news or when you see it in print, if your communication system is that antiquated, you'll be prepared for it. Oh, yes, I know all about pole shifts. All I need to do is make sure that I have my NitroPak supplies and I can survive for the few weeks that it's going to disrupt my lifestyle. And if you want to know more about this, you can go to the Horizon Project. There is a Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. You can click on that and you can learn more about it. And you can either be prepared or you can choose not to be prepared. The choice is yours. Also wanted to let you know that Space Shuttle Endeavour was supposed to launch today, temporarily grounded by a hydrogen leak. It should be ready to launch on June 17th, according to a Sunday evening announcement by NASA. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is currently scheduled to launch on that same date, so the moon mission could be bumped back to June 19th or 20th. The situation will sort itself out in the next 24 to 48 hours as repairs on the Endeavour proceed. We do have a caller on line one. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. This is Mark from Ohio.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a bunch. I had a few questions about this pole shift, if I may ask a few.
Sure, go ahead.
How large, just to kind of back up for a minute, there's a black hole at the center of our galaxy. And how large is that black hole?
Well, they estimate it could be as much as 80 light years across, which is, that's pretty significant. Now, that being said, they're assuming that it's spherical. There are many theorists out there, I'm one of them, who don't think that it's spherical. We believe in our community that as black holes become supermassive, that is to say, the equivalent mass of millions of suns piled into it, that they're already rotating at their maximum speed, they become non-spherical. They sort of flatten out like an accretion disk. And that being said, the vibrational embed, the ripples that it causes in space-time, are not symmetrical. They are much stronger at the axis than they are at the equator than they are at the axes. And the Milky Way is laid out such as like a giant spiral. So those stars that lay along that axial line, that radial line, I'm sorry, are going to be subjected to much stronger gravitational waves than those that are situated axially. And we happen to be located radially.
Now, there is a plane, a gravitational plane that comes out from this black hole. I was wondering, how thick is that plane?
That's a really good question. It's theorized that the plane is thicker as you go toward the center of the galaxy, thinner as you go away from the center of the galaxy. There is some evidence for that. If you go to LIGO.org, it's L-I-G-O, it stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, you will see some mathematical embeds that they have projected based on what they can measure, which are coalescing neutron stars. They have been unable to measure directly a black hole as of yet. But that being said, October of this last year, they did some upgrades at the Hanford site. This is Hanford, Washington. And they expect that later on this year, they're going to be able to increase the sensitivity of that instrument one or two orders of magnitude. If they're able to do that, it's quite possible they'll be able to detect the rippling of space-time from the black hole in the center of the galaxy.
I've heard that the gravitational disk might even be paper thin in some places. Do you agree with that? Or?
Well, you're thinking two-dimensionally. Yeah, it is probably paper thin, but we are talking about a ripple of space-time. So if you look at the amplitude, that is the distance from the peak of the vibration to the other peak of the vibration, like a sinusoidal wave, and then you look at that cross-section, you're probably talking about several million miles thick. But yes, the actual gravitational force is probably paper thin.
And what causes the pole shift? Is it our solar system moving through the center of this area?
Well, that's a good question. Coriolis instabilities are normally caused by a close pass by another gravitational body. That is to say, something like an errant or a rogue planet coming through our solar system, tugging at our planet as it passes by. That may have been responsible for our planet leaning over 23 degrees on its axis already, but it is going to have a gravitational effect that's outside those normal effects that we have in our somewhat stable solar system, that is to say the sun and whatever perturbation the other planets have upon us. We now have a new perturbation thrown into the formula, and that has an effect on the very dense core and the very dense crust of Earth, and that upsets the balance between the two and could precipitate a pole shift. The other trigger could be this periodic passing of the solar system through the galaxy plane.
So it could be one of two things. It could be moving through the galactic plane or some other body in the solar system, like a Planet X type thing.
Yes, and there's a third, and that is that maybe the gravitational waves that we are going to experience as we pass through the rift of the Milky Way are not aligned with the plane of the galaxy, because there are some cosmologists who say, oh gosh, we're not going to pass through the galactic plane for another 300 years, so why are we even worried about 2012? But there is another plane, because this galaxy isn't alone. It sort of swallowed another galaxy called the Sagittarius Galaxy, which wasn't an easy transition, shall I say. They kind of came at each other at different angles. And it's theorized that Earth came from the Sagittarius Galaxy and was adopted by the Milky Way Galaxy. Well, that movement of one galactic plane through another shifted the gravitational plane of the supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy with the galactic plane. So we're actually passing through a gravitational plane before we pass through the galactic plane.
Wow, this gets more and more complicated the more you learn about it. So is this severe weather that we're having, is it caused by the movement of the solar system through this gravitational plane?
That's a really good question. Normally, weather changes occur on Earth because of the presence or non-presence of high clouds over the Earth. High clouds over the Earth are normally caused by solar radiation coming in and causing cosmic rays high up in the atmosphere. That causes sort of an ionic fog up there very high in the atmosphere, and that reflects some of the sun's rays. The Earth cools, and then it goes through this cycle. But that's not what's been occurring lately. As I fly around the world, and I have done so, I guess, for about the last 40 days, one way or another, I went to China and Korea and back to California and across the nation a couple times, I noticed the entire Atlantic, or the entire Pacific Ocean, was covered in clouds. In fact, 3/4 of the Northern Hemisphere is covered in clouds. That means that the sun's rays don't reach the Earth. They're dissipated in the atmosphere. And that means that the Earth doesn't warm up like it's supposed to. So, gosh, we're supposed to be in the middle of global warming, and yet 2 weeks ago we had record cold in New York with frost, and this morning we had record cold in Chicago. We haven't even broke 59 degrees in Chicago yet. So, we have a lot of upset in our weather, and that is the big question. What is it caused by? Is it caused by greenhouse gases? Is it caused by high altitude particulate matter? Is it caused by a fluctuating ozone layer? Are we being bombarded by radiation from other stars or other sources? And the answer to all those questions is yes. We are being bombarded by a new kind of radiation at a new frequency. Those photons are at a frequency that we have not seen in about 26,000 years. And it's having its effect. on just about everything.
My last question, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the phone here, is how did the Mayans know about all these different things? And thank you very much, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Well, I love this question because that is a, you know, when, if you go down to Teotihuacan, I encourage you to take a tour. Sure, go ahead and do that. Learn about the size of the city and all the Mayans that lived there and how Cortez was involved in converting the country away from their somewhat pagan religion, as they supposed. But I also encourage you to poke around on your own and just open your mind up and see what you can see. The reality is, if you have the lungs for it, because you're already at about 8,000 feet, climb the Temple of the Moon. It's a little smaller than the Temple of the Sun. It's at the end of the Avenue of the Dead. Climb the Temple of the Moon and sit up there for about half an hour and just look to the north. To the north and slightly off to the left, you'll see the Temple of the Sun. And you'll also see very well excavated streets and some plumbing and where they used to have water and what looks like baptismal fonts and all kinds of living quarters and that. That's wonderful. But pan your eyes over to the left when you get the chance. And you will notice dozens and dozens of other buildings that are covered in dirt. The dirt being a wonderful home for grass and weeds, and so it looks like lots of little hills out there. They're not. They're buildings. What you realize in very short order, if you look at some of the ancient paintings, not the ones that have been replicated, but the ones that didn't burn away because the plaster was organic and was flammable and burned off of those temples. So while you're standing on the Temple of the Moon, even though you realize it's a pyramid, it was once encased in a very pretty white kind of alabaster mortar. The building itself is made with cement and rock, with tiny little lava stones stuck into the mortar to make it almost impervious to earthquakes. But what you realize is that the Mayans didn't build this city at all. This city was built a long time before the Mayans got there, and they just walked up on it in one of their migratory moves and adopted it. What you realize is that there were great teachers that existed anciently in the Mayan community, and even pre-Mayan, going back to the Zapotecs, going back to the Olmecs, 3000 BC. They were called the Shining Ones in their own language. Small numbers of teachers came. Some of them had wings. Some of them just wore feathers. There are depictions of their craft that they flew into the area. And they taught these people about cosmology. They taught these people about where the earth came from, why it was important to them, having liquid water over a large amount of the planet, and why the Mayans themselves, why the Olmecs and the Zapotecs and the Toltecs were important to them, and why it was important for them not only to learn about these things, but also to pass them along to subsequent generations. And we'll go into this a little bit more. Well, right now we have a caller on line two. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. My name is Wayne. I'm calling from Austin, Texas. But I'll tell you, my home is actually in Idaho.
Well, that's great. I love the bilocation. It's a great idea.
Well, if it was more my choice, it's a business trip. But it ends tomorrow, and I'm so happy to be getting back home. I have a few questions that I would like to discuss with you.
You bet.
First, I just want to really compliment you on the ARC book series. You use so many references in ancient scriptures and things that if I tried to research that, it would take me decades. So I really appreciate all of the things that you must have researched, that you had to go through to put this information down. It's incredible.
Wow, I really appreciate the compliment. I have to include my co-author, E.J. Clark, who probably did just that, about 30 years of research. And when we hooked up, actually, we had done collectively almost 60 years of research on the same subject independently. So when we came together, we had quite a Rolodex.
Well, that is fascinating. Well, I can see that it would take, like I said, decades to get all of this. In fact, I got your third book after a Coast to Coast show, and I listened to the first two volumes, then I read the third volume, and I since bought the other two volumes, and I'm reading the first. And so that's where a few of my questions I would like to go with tonight.
Okay.
And then perhaps the first time, one on the subject that you started off with. So if I understand the union of the polarity that occurred, that kind of culminated about the same time as Noah and his ark settled. If I understand, that's correct.
That's why we named the books the Ark of Millions of Years, because that's what Noah called his ship.
He called it the Ark of Millions of Years, or just the Ark?
No, he actually called it the Ark of Millions of Years. It's if you go back to the Egyptian, you'll see that quite commonly recorded in there. Many people think that the first five books of the Bible were recorded by Moses, but that has turned out probably to be a fallacy. It was probably recorded by Egyptians or pre-Egyptians, and so that's where the name, the Ark of Millions of Years, came from. But go ahead with your question.
Well, that's fascinating. I had missed that, or I had forgotten it when I'd gone through the audio. So that polarity is once again going to separate. Is that, and perhaps in the area of 2012, is that somewhat correct?
Yes, that is somewhat correct. According to what we were able to dig up in the ancient record and then back up with physics, is that Earth is actually two forms of matter occupying the same space at the same time. One, a very high vibrational matter. Some call this spirit matter. Some people call it just a higher matter. And another form of matter called temporal matter, or what some call lower matter, or low vibrational matter. And the interesting thing about it is when you look at, say, the human body, you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, you realize that you're not the bag of calcium and protein and water that you see in the mirror. You are this animated energy being inside this body. So you are two forms of matter occupying the same space at the same time, just like the Earth.
Right. So when I picture, in my own perhaps difficult way, that spirit that occupies my physical or temporal body, would we think that the spiritual Earth would be much like that spirit, which some measurements have shown it to be something like, I believe, a tenth of an ounce measured at the time of passing of some people, of some, you know, some subjects. Would is that how you would perceive the spiritual Earth to be composed?
Well, if I was comparing it to in this dimension, as people normally try to compare the spirit of a human being in this dimension, that is to say the third dimension, yeah, I would probably, you know, weigh it or measure it just about that way. But what we really have to realize is that we're dealing with multiple dimensions here. And the Earth, as it came across space with Noah and merged with this physical Earth here, although cataclysmic to both worlds, it wasn't an extinction event. It was just a merging of two forms of this planet, one in the fourth dimension, one in the third dimension. And now they are in in somewhat of a level of harmony. That is to say, even though they're vibrating at different frequencies, they're in harmony with one another, so they can exist together. But as time goes on and we get closer to this rift in the Milky Way, the two go out of harmony with one another. They become dissident to one another, almost destructively interfering with one another. And what will happen is they will eventually come apart again, except that this time the spirit Earth will have elevated to the fifth dimension. That's why the Mayans often talked about the fifth sun. And that's why, even Jesus talked about the sun teleion, the end of the age. This is the end of the age of the Earth itself.
Very well. And then when I try to put this on the three-dimensional plane, I am really restricting it. It's much beyond that. That is, the spiritual Earth will be much beyond what little bit of understanding we might have.
Right. And that's not to say that, again, either one of them will disappear or be destroyed. It won't. The temporal Earth and the three-dimensional Earth will continue on. And the fifth-dimensional Earth, with those beings and that amount of matter that resonates with that dimension, will go on with that Earth. They will just not perceive each other after a while.
Oh, that does help. Then many of the prophetic writings, both in the Book of Revelation and other writings, talk of the last day events. Can we conclude that some of those events specifically refer to just the temporal Earth after the separation, and some of them refer to just the spiritual Earth after the separation?
Well, yes, you can draw that conclusion and be pretty safe. One thing people have to realize about the Book of Revelations is it isn't where it belongs in the New Testament at all. It should be much closer to Luke instead of, you know, at the end of the book. It was actually written chronologically before two-thirds of the New Testament. The other thing that they have to realize is that this is a prophetic writing that came to John in a series of visions, and it does pertain to both past and future events. Some of the things that John talks about in Revelations are historical events, historical cataclysmic events that already occurred on this earth, and some of them are events that are going to occur.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't realized that before. I will keep that in mind as I read next time. Okay, so this is my last question, Dr. Agnew, and this refers to something that you said earlier on in the program tonight. Referring to the magnetism of the Earth and ions, and I jotted this down. Did I understand? I work in electronics, and so I've been somewhat familiar with both. But I gathered, in fact, as you were describing the tether, the magnetic flux. Actually, it sounded like you were saying that it actually carries with it ions, that ions that are picked up by the wire are picked up because they are there with the magnetic fields?
No. Actually, it was Faraday that discovered this, that if you move a wire through a magnetic field, it will induce a current flow in that wire.
Right.
That's the Faraday effect. And there's a certain amount of resistance that goes with that. What I was talking about was the dynamo effect, which was basically an experiment that was done where a wire was stretched across a moving river of water, and current flowed through the wire from one end to the other. And it was said that it was the ions of the river passing over the wire that were inducing the current flow, and some even said that some of the ions actually shunt to the wire and then move to either end of it, depending on their polarity, and create that current flow. Well, the experiment that was done in space where they dragged a tether behind the space shuttle. Only one end of it was connected, and that was the end that was connected to the space shuttle and to the measurement equipment. But in a very few moments, this 20-mile-long tether developed so much energy that it exploded. They never got to complete the experiment because the amount of energy that they gathered from the tether simply being dragged at 18,000 miles an hour through the magnetosphere was so high that it overloaded the experiment and exploded the tether.
It even put the shuttle in some jeopardy, as I recall.
Yeah, and fortunately, the tether couldn't carry that much current, even though it was several million volts that came across the tether. The tether exploding wasn't really, you know, cataclysmic to the shuttle because it didn't carry that much current. Had it been able to carry the current, it might have been, you know, catastrophic for the space shuttle. But the cool thing is they discovered a source of energy. They just maybe had too long of a wire to be able to handle it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. I blended a couple of things that you were saying, and I blended them together when they didn't belong. And that all makes sense now. Well, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk to you for a very long time. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, do me a favor and don't wait a very long time to call again. We just really like to talk on the phone. So if you another Sunday night want to call in, you're automatically welcome.
Well, I appreciate that, and I will.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night. So, you know, as we discuss these things, and we've got to understand about the listeners to X Squared Radio, they're all over the world out there. Some of them listen live, like Mark and like the gentleman that just called us from Texas through his Idaho phone. They are the more I'm not going to call them eclectic. I'm going to call them the higher echelon of listener. There are other programs out there that discuss items in the news, and they're entertainers, and I understand that, and certainly we're trying to do entertainment as well, but we try to discuss things as deeply as the listener wants to go. And we might discuss physics, and we might discuss cosmology, we might discuss religion, and all of that's fine. Bring it all here, and we'll discuss it here, because the mysteries of the universe and of the earth are what we are all about. We're trying to figure it out. Some of it we have figured out, and we'd like to share it with you. So if you come here, don't expect to hear a church or a preaching or some recommendation that you join this or that. What you're going to realize in very short order is that you are a sovereign being, and you have access to source within yourself. And so when you look at things less eschatologically, you will have less fear and be much more empowered to be able to do things with your life and thus with the lives around you. And that's what we're really all about here. So if you want to come and join us, you are automatically welcome to come and join us anytime. And we have another caller on line one. I think it's Ramon. Welcome to the program.
How's it going?
I was calling up because
I was looking forward to talk to you about Britney Spears' new gossip.
Well, that one would catch me off guard for sure.
No, actually, there's something I've been thinking about for a few weeks, probably like a month. We were speaking about Atlantis a couple months ago. I forgot the name of the speaker you had on when I was talking about the Empire State Buildings and buildings that looked like that. Do you remember that conversation?
Well, it might have been L.A. Mazzulli.
Yes. He has that book, Something History.
Right. Well, you would have to ask me what his book is. I forgot. But, yes, I remember the conversation.
Well, anyway, so I was thinking, what can sink if there's, let's just say there's a continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and the only thing I could think of, there's and correct me if I'm wrong, there's a huge ridge in the Atlantic Ocean, correct?
Yes, there is. It's east of the Mindanao Trench, correct.
Okay. Now, what if that wasn't a trench at one time, and this, and above it is this continent, and then all of a sudden it splits open, and it shoots straight down to the bottom? Wouldn't that cause such a massive flood that would actually flood the entire world? And then you will also get these crashings of waves into the North and South Pole, or what would be the North and South Pole at that time? So you will have the water rise immediately?
What there is evidence of around the Earth is not necessarily a universal flood, per se. That is to say, a gently rising water like you would see in Indiana or something if the Mississippi went over its bounds. The evidence more points to extremely high velocity, very high wave activity. And by high velocity, I mean, you know, barely subsonic, 500 miles an hour, waves in the realm of 2 to 3 miles high. And when you see those kinds of wave evidences, and I'll give you an example. In the Nordic regions, way up in the mountains, there's a phenomenon commonly called muck vents. These muck vents are cracks in the mountains that are just jammed full of a slurry-like cement. And that slurry-like cement is made of a blended mix of bones and rocks and soil and little tiny bodies. The interesting thing is when they drill into these muck vents and they recover the organic record inside of these muck vents, and keep in mind this is a sudden and cataclysmic event that jams mud into these cracks. What they find are giant shark bones, saber-tooth bones, and human bones all mixed into one. This is a single event, cataclysmic, that occurred at once. And it's stirred up by literally wiping continents clean of their life. And much like gravel, you know, rolling down a river or down a waterfall during a flood, all of the organic material gets pulverized into this slurry and got jammed into these high-altitude vents. And some of these vents are up around 7,000 feet in altitude, just to give you an idea how high some of these waves were.
That's the reason I was thinking that the only thing that can cause that is, let's put Australia in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and then somewhere where there's no ridge, there's no Atlantic Ridge, and all of a sudden you open it up to the width of what it is now, that continent sinking all of a sudden should create those waves high enough and fast enough to do the evidence that you're finding.
I agree. Now you're thinking of Australia as a size of a continent, not the actual continent that was in the Atlantic, right?
I'm just giving an example.
Right. Yeah, I think you're onto something there because, you know, just because we look at our Earth now and we say, oh, gee, isn't it neat how all these continents sort of fit together? Maybe they were all in one place over on one side of the Earth. But if you actually look at the Earth as a shrunken version of its current form, guess what? All those continents fit neatly together like a key in a lock. And there are some missing regions, and I think that's exactly the region you're looking at, Ramon.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. I used to have, and I'll tie it back together to what we're talking about. I used to have really long dreadlocks, and at times it looked for like a couple months, it looked like it wouldn't grow at all, and all of a sudden it would be 2 inches longer. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because the hair would curl, and then all of a sudden, because of the way of the locks, it's stretched out. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because it's like the earth growing would kind of do the same, and all of a sudden stretch out. So you have like these, and this is just me coming up with this right now, so I could be completely wrong, would all of a sudden stretch out, and then you would have these cataclysmic earthquakes, probably something that happens every, I don't know, before we kept record, or somebody did probably keep record and someone's hiding it.
I think you're exactly right, and by cataclysm, we're not talking about something that shakes buildings to the ground. We're talking about something that forces the oceans out of its bounds at extremely high velocity. And what happened in Malaysia was just a tiny snapshot of what you would see happen. I don't know if you've taken the opportunity to look at the before and after pictures of Google Earth of Malaysia before and after that very small tidal wave, only about 35 feet high. But it's amazing. What you see before is a town, and what you see after is sand. Well, this is the kind of thing that happens to Florida, happens to North and South Carolina up against the Appalachians, happens to New York State, happens to Virginia. You know, we go from cities with skyscrapers to a sandbar in a matter of hours.
There's, in Central Park, I don't know if you've ever been to Central Park, but there's an area where they have these boulders that you can tell do not sit there. And in science class, they took us there and they told us it was the ice sheets that pushed them all the way down from Canada. These are Canadian boulders. And I was sitting there and I was thinking about what you were saying, that no, it wasn't ice sheets, that it could have been massive water that would have pushed these, which actually makes more sense, because I just can't see. I would think the ice sheet would just go over.
Yeah, one thing about ice is when it's approached with pressure, it melts. That's why we have the game of hockey. So a large boulder, say 50 or 80 tons, is not lifted by ice at all. It sinks to the bottom of the ice, and ice can even rip it to pieces, but it isn't going to be pushed by ice at all. And contrary to popular belief, ice does not flow uphill. So these errant boulders, these boulders that exist all over Scotland and Ireland and the Northeast that don't belong there, they weren't moved there by ice, I can tell you that.
Yeah. One other thing I heard on James Gilliland's show, and I've heard it said before by other contactees, was the, to kind of change the subject a little bit, the triangle ships, and how, I can't remember the exact words he said, but something... They're made, these ships are made of such a different high-dimensional matter that you look at it, it's huge from the outside, but they're so much huger if you was to walk in. So that's to say, I'm looking at your house, and let's say you have a two-story house, and I walk into your house, and it's all of a sudden four or five stories and four times as big. And I can't remember, he said something about the matter being some kind of electron energy being so small. Don't quote me on it. I'm obviously saying it wrong. But the energy that they use to make these ships make them bigger inside than they are in the outside. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. I wish I could go into more detail on it. But I can't. It's not because I'm not allowed. It's just that this isn't the right venue for me to talk about this kind of stuff. Unless, in our normal way out there third hour, we want to talk about it. But I have to be very, I wasn't going to say careful. I just need to be maybe perhaps more conservative. When I talk about stuff like this, because I don't want to share any personal information, because the show isn't about me, it's about what you guys can bring to the table. But that is a very, very interesting concept that somewhere out there somebody understands that on the outside, these things look pretty small, but when you step into them, you get to see everything.
Oh, the reason why I brought that up was because I know I've spoken to you about this plenty of times. When you're sitting there in meditation and you open your eyes and you just put focus, let's say, on the wall and you're not paying attention to anything in particular, I start to notice that everything has an energy pattern, and even a piece of pen mark that you might have marked the wall has an energy signature. And you start to see these geometric shapes. Yeah, I know I spoke to you about them. And the reason why I was bringing that up, because I've heard so many different people say that that's like those geometric shapes you see are on a higher dimension or a higher plane. So this is why I was trying to match those two things together.
Mm.
Maybe I'm shooting in the dark, but that's the reason why I brought it up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming to the end of hour two, Ramon.
All right. I appreciate you taking my phone call, and I'll keep listening.
All right. I appreciate you so much. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, there we have it, Earth Explorers. End of hour two here at X Squared Radio. You never know where the third hour is going to go, so you might want to hang around. And don't forget, our phone lines are open. We're going to be talking about peak oil and what it means to you. Are we running out? Do we have enough? Hang around. X Squared Radio. We'll be back after about 3 minutes. X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWindow forecast clear. outside, about 73 degrees, which is quite refreshing. Normally it's about 173 degrees, and we appreciate the reprieve. It's been raining a lot more than usual here in Idaho. Those of you that listen to this program on a regular basis know that I have been out in Kentucky, and what we were looking for out there, we were driving the electric car around the Corbin Speedway, demonstrating it for the public and let them know that the electric car plant is coming to Kentucky. Global Green Cars was successful in receiving a $15 million award from the state of Kentucky and passed their first round of review for their $24 million DOE grant. So it looks like things are coming together for mass production of electric cars. Who would have thought it wouldn't be the big three that would come out with the electric vehicle? It would be an independent one that's been around for about 15 years, actually. At one time was the largest producer of electric vehicles in the United States. When General Motors refused to produce the electric car, they sold us the Geos in 1993, 94, 95, and we turned them into electric vehicles. And people bought them like crazy, and they're still on the road more than 10 million miles later without a major failure. And Ford was gracious enough to sell us brand new Ford Rangers. In 93, 94, and 95, we converted those into electrics as well. I am sitting about, 100 feet from a 1993 Ford Ranger. We just pulled it out of the garage, put new batteries in it, and it runs as nice as it did when it was built 16 years ago and outperforms every electric truck on the market. That being said, the new trucks that are coming out are a rather unique design. They're the most popular pickup truck in Asia, not sold in the U.S. yet, except for what are called NEVs. These are neighborhood electric vehicles, which are basically golf carts that can carry a few rocks in the back. What Global Green Cars will build will be an actual freeway-ready, drive-the-American-way vehicle. It will be the most American-made small pickup truck in America. Right now, the most American-made pickup truck is only 68% American. This one will be 70% American, built by Americans for Americans, and we're happy to provide the jobs. Don't forget, if you're out on the Internet, to go to X Squared Radio, because we have some really, really good affiliates, and I want you to visit some of them. One of them is Academic Superstore. If you're in the market for software, and I'm talking name brand software, Adobe Photoshop, we're talking the Microsoft suites, any of that, and you're a student, you can get up to 75% off on some of this software. Not only that, you can get all kinds of college supplies, school supplies. Don't be stuck paying those high bookstore prices or even the high, shall we call them, superstore prices. You could do much, much better than that by clicking on the Academic Superstore banner at X Squared Radio and picking up AutoCAD or Minitab or any one of those very high dollar pieces of software for fractions of a dollar. We also wanted to let you know that the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy is still selling pretty well. The best place to buy it is at the website, arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark. The free audio version of Volumes 1 and Volume 2 are still given out free. If you buy the trilogy, you will get the first two volumes in audio. We have a special price on all three books put together. They're a great addition to your library, and Volume 3 is in process of being recorded as well. So that audio version will be out there for you probably later on this year, hopefully in time for Christmas. it takes a while to sit down and read 30 hours without making a mistake. And still, we make mistakes, but that's cool. We're human, and hopefully so are you. And also, our friends at NRG Resources have moved on. So TVT 24/7 is now back under the auspices of a Green Star Products. And I don't know if you know about TVT 24/7, really a remarkable product. It reduces engine wear to nothing. And as it turns out, the cutting fluid has been remarkably successful in the drilling industry. It reduces friction up to 25%, which means that drilling, and I don't care if you're drilling into steel or if you're drilling into the ground, your tools will last longer and your speed will pick up. Even the sound of your equipment will change. This is a remarkable, remarkable lubricant. And if you want to get your hands on it, all you have to do is go to Green Star USA and make your inquiry. And we will be back in about 60 seconds, so don't go away. This is X Squared Radio. We're happy you're here with us tonight on X Squared Radio, coming to you live from Western Idaho, third and final hour. Anything can happen in the third hour of an X Squared Radio program. We come to you every Sunday evening between 5 and 8 p.m. Pacific live, and you can always listen to the archives by going to bbsradio.com and subscribing. Or if you want to, you can subscribe at xsquaredradio.com. Either way, fine with us. And those of you that are listening on Conscious Media Network, thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to patronize our studios at bbsradio.com. Lots and lots of great content there. And if you are an aspiring talk radio host, you've got an idea, you think you can make it speaking to people all over the world, now is your chance. Go to bbsradio.com and find out if you have what it takes to be a talk radio host. The nice thing about the internet is you can be a host from your own home. You don't have to go down to the local radio station, and you can even broadcast barefoot, as I am tonight. bbsradio.com. Give a call down there, talk to Don, and get signed up. Lots of openings, and we could use your voice. Peak oil. What does that mean to the average person? Well, it's sort of like peak power, I guess. What is the peak demand of oil, crude oil, throughout the world? Well, unfortunately for our short-sightedness as a human race, we choose to drill into our planet, pump crude oil to the surface, which has long since been produced by prehistoric algae colonies all over the planet, converting methane and sunlight into oxygen and sugar so that we could survive on the earth, and they died by the ocean's load and seeped into the deep places of the earth, and we pump it out. Unfortunately for our short-sightedness, as I was saying, we choose to dig it up and burn it. It works so much nicer when you make computer keyboards out of it, and wrappings for electrical wire, and fiber for clothing, and plastics for lenses, and rubber for shoes, and all kinds of products that are durable goods, durable, lasting goods. Yes, it is a problem when those plastic bags get thrown into the sea, or on the ocean, or on the forest floor, and last for 1,000 years. That is most unfortunate. but it is kind of nice to have a steering wheel of your car that doesn't dissolve in your hands, to have things like contact lenses and arterial stents and even string made from oil. This is the proper use for oil. It is not meant to put into a tank, spray into a cylinder, ignite with electricity, and burn. That is archaic. That is like stepping out with your TI-84 slide rule and your highly polished glass lens and mirror for your telescope, and then turning around and lighting a fire by rubbing two sticks together. I'm telling you, we need to grow up as a planet. We need to realize there is a proper use for crude oil, and it is not as a fuel. There are better things to use as fuel today. However, let's look at the peak oil situation and just see if we have hundreds of years of oil left through which we can drive our cars and our trucks any way we want as long as we have the money to buy the fuel. In the United States, we have traditionally enjoyed the cheapest oil prices, I should say the cheapest gas prices in the world. If you go to Europe, you're going to spend, probably close to $5 a gallon, maybe a little bit more by the time you convert for the euro. If you drive in China, you're going to spend about 90 yuan for a liter of gasoline. It is not uncommon to find two-cylinder cars less than 600 cc's. Do they accelerate? No. Can they burn rubber? No. But their highways are only 70-kilometer roads. That's about 45 miles an hour. There is no 85-mile-an-hour highways elsewhere in the world unless you want to go to the UK or parts of Germany. And I say only parts of Germany. Most of Germany is about 70 kilometers per hour. That being said, what do we do? I mean, is there enough to last? No, there is not. Let's talk about a little bit of reality here. United States has about 2% of the world's oil supply. 2%. And yet, we consume about 25% of the world's oil. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist or even a genius at political science to realize that it isn't our friends who have the great reservoirs of oil. Oh, far from it. In fact, some of these people are our enemies. But they realize that the American dollar allows them to live the lifestyles they want. They don't have any natural resources. They don't have trees or iron. They don't have high technology to export. They're not great literary creators, and they don't even have great works of art to share. If they do, they don't even know how to market them. What they do have is oil, and that they market aggressively to us because we are such a big consumer of it. Russia, Kazakhstan, also great suppliers of oil. They export oil. They also use oil. China, if you haven't been there lately, you should go. You can get a visa for about $100. It lasts for a year. It costs about as much to go to China as it does to Toronto. Get on a plane, get over there, and look at one of the great countries of the world. You won't see any human rights violations. What you will see is human ingenuity. What you will see are not hundreds of skyscrapers going up. You'll see thousands of skyscrapers going up. You'll see welding going on 24 hours a day, cement being poured around the clock. You will see roads and dams and bridges and projects and universities everywhere. This is a country you would think is ready to enter the middle class and thus ready to drive their Ford Mustang just the way we did when it first came out. Not so. They are much more responsible with their natural resources. I went to Beijing. I was on the 23rd floor in Beijing. I was there for several days. Guess what I saw? As far as I wanted to see, all of the coal power plant stacks were empty. Empty. They have moved beyond that. They have better sources of power now. They have lots of things happening in that country that we should be doing here. One of the things that you notice is that when you look at traffic, it has a different makeup than our traffic. Instead of mile after mile after mile of V8s with air conditioning and stereos sitting like a giant steel caterpillar, lane after lane after lane, moving at 10 or 15 miles an hour going to work, you don't see that at all. What you do see are thousands and thousands of electric bikes, electric scooters, small bore motorcycles, small bore cars, small bore trucks. You see what would be the equivalent of a semi in this country, except it only has 1,600 cc's or 2,000 cc's turbo diesel. Do they need to run fast? No. They move at a normal speed, just like we do, 40 or 50 miles an hour, just like our roads. Yes, there are times when you can drive 70 or 75 miles an hour, of course. Same as over there. And you see people driving fast over there, too. But most of the time, if you're driving I-5, or you're driving the 110, or you're driving the 710, or you're driving the Pasadena Freeway, if you're going from San Pedro on the Harbor Freeway, or you're going down the San Diego Freeway, or you're going to Ventura Freeway, you aren't going anywhere very fast. You're going about 30 to 35 miles an hour. So why do you have a vehicle that registers 140 on the speedometer, or even 120 on the speedometer? Why should you care about a vehicle that goes 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds? Why should you care about 285 horsepower under the hood when you never get to use it? And if you do, you end up paying a fine for it. Exactly. It's because we don't have the right attitude about peak oil, and they do. They realize that there's only a limited amount of oil on the planet, and it needs to be used for durable goods. Once it's poured into your fuel tank, it goes away forever. You never get to use it again. It's burned, it's wasted, it's gone. Where does it go? Right into the atmosphere. And where does it go from there? It's washed out of the atmosphere by the rain, right into the soil. Right on top of the trees of the Smoky Mountains, killing them. Right into our oceans, from which we fish for our food, and then we consume it. So peak oil is a reality. It is running out. And those that own it realize there has not been a new giant reservoir of oil discovered since 1973. That's right. So when you hear the news of a couple billion barrels being found here, or the Anwar Wilderness, or off the coast of Florida, or deep in Russia, peanuts, peanuts wouldn't get us through a long weekend. All of the major oil reserves have been found, and they're being pumped. You might not know it, but the Alaska pipeline is down to about a third of what it once pumped. The reservoirs in Saudi Arabia, down 66% from where they were. That's why they're trying to make it stretch. That's why when they realized that their reservoirs were running low, and one day that pump would go down, and it would come back up with nothing. And when it did, their reign of wealth was over. The age of $20 a barrel oil was over. Now the age of $50 a barrel oil is over. And there is talk overseas in Asia by those who know, those who are planning for industry, those that are planning for industrial use of energy. They know that oil is headed for $200, perhaps even $250 a barrel. What does that mean for you? Does that mean you have to park your gasoline car? Yes, it does. Does it mean that you have to find an alternate fuel or an alternate engine? Yes, it does. Who is going to produce that engine? Do you think General Motors is going to step up to the plate and start producing this new engine? Do you think Ford Motor Company or Chrysler is going to somehow retool all of its plants and introduce that secret engine it's had on its back shelf for 40 years? You are fooling yourself. It isn't going to happen. A giant once walking cannot turn. The new technology is going to come out of the garages and the attics and the basements and the backyards of intelligent people. I know you don't believe me, but it's true. How is it going to do that? Is John Doe going to open the redwood gate beside his house and walk out with a new Mr. Fusion in his arms, ready to throw it into mass production, stick it in the front of your Cadillac so you can keep driving it forever? Roads, we don't need roads. I doubt it. The industrial machine takes money. It takes millions and millions of dollars to build those buildings, to put those assembly lines together, to create those wages for people who will sit at those machines and will put in those nuts and bolts and wires and screws and do the packaging and the driving and the shipping. Where does that millions of dollars come from? Where does the money come from? I will tell you, it comes from you, the consumer. But there's a little bit of a time lag because you can't go down to the car dealership and say, by the way, I want to buy that Cadillac with the Mr. Fusion that Dr. Agnew talked about on the radio, and here's my down payment. Well, it's not going to happen that way. It never happens that way. First you have supply, and then demand catches up with it, and then it takes off from there. These are irrefutable laws of nature, my friends. First you have the grass, then you have the cows, and then you have the McDonald's, not before. So, where does the grass come from? Where does the fuel come from to create this alternative, what we would call alternative, this new form of energy? Well, I'll tell you, the other countries have it figured out. China is very aggressively, today, Monday in China. Right now it's Sunday here, but it's Monday there. And they are working on their electric versions of their SUVs. They're working on their electric versions of their trucks. And we're not talking neighborhood electric vehicles. We're not talking golf carts. We're not talking playthings for the wealthy. We're talking about the necessities of life. Delivering cabbage to the store, delivering students to school, driving to the office, carrying every single finished goods that is made anywhere in that country from one point to another and delivering it to the consumer at that local store. Everything will be delivered by alternative energy very soon in these countries. We call it alternative energy because we just know we can go to any street corner in any town, in any state of this country, and we can fill up with gas. But those days are coming to an end. The lines that we had in the 70s, they're coming back. Being able to fuel because you have an even Social Security number, those days are coming back. Back in the 40s, when we used to ration things like sugar, and gasoline and oil, and we would trade stamps so that we could buy the different commodities that we needed because they were limited supply. Those days are coming back. The interstates belonging to the federal government will be limited for official use only. There'll be no more driving to Florida for spring break. There'll be no driving coast to coast in your private car. You'll have to use mass transportation. Unless you, the consumer, realize that the fuel-less transportation is laying at your feet right now. Companies are coming to fruition right now, today, this month. They are producing vehicles that don't use gasoline. They don't use diesel fuel. They use cheap electricity. You charge them up at night when electricity is almost free. Nuclear power plants can't shut down at night. They can't just shut down and start up every 12 hours. They run on an average amount of usage. You can't stop rivers from flowing. Those hydroelectric plants run 24 hours a day. As long as there's water behind the dam, they got to run. That means the electricity at night is cheap. So you might as well charge up an electric car. Drive the way you're used to driving. Gosh, if you want to go 0 to 60 in 7 or 8 seconds, it's here. You want to drive 100 miles an hour, it's here. You want to haul a 1,000-pound payload in a small pickup truck, it's here. You want to go to and from work all week long without spending a penny out of your pocket for fuel, it's here. It's already here. All you have to do as a consumer is decide that you want to drive an electric car instead of a gasoline car. You need to decide that you are sick and tired of spending $300 or $400 a month for gasoline, and you would rather have that money back in your pocket. We're not going to build any more refineries in this country. It is not politically correct, it's not ecologically correct, and we don't need them. What we do need to do is make room. We need to drive electric cars so that our refineries can shift away from making gasoline for your Cadillac and toward making chemicals for durable goods. Polyols for plastic and nylon and polyethylene and polypropylene and ABS plastic, so we can have more roller skates, so we can have more motorcycle helmets, so we can have more tires and those things that last. We can have more laptop frames and more microphones and more mouses for our computers. Those are the things that you make with oil. Don't burn it. In fact, if you've listened to this program and you have a friend that doesn't get it, why don't you give them a copy of this program and let them listen to it? And let them realize as they sit down at their plastic desk in their vinyl chair with plastic feet and plastic wheels, looking at their laptop with a light bulb lighting their desk, that almost every single product that touches them right now is made from oil. And what sense would it be to forego these products that last for the pleasure of driving 18.7 miles on a gallon of gasoline? We don't need it. Grow up. We are now a modern 21st century planet, and we don't burn oil anymore. We don't rub sticks together to make fire. And maybe, once we figure that out, maybe we don't fight anymore. We don't have to send anybody in uniform anywhere to protect foreign interests anywhere. Nobody does. Because everything we need is right here. Everything they need is right there. There's no reason to not trade. There's no reason to not work together. We have one planet, one. Travel as far as you want, 30,000 light years in every direction. There is nothing like this planet. Do you realize we have liquid water on the surface of our world? liquid water is rare in this universe. We are in a perfect position to live in complete harmony with our planet, and we could do it this decade. It's 2009. By 2019, 10 years from now, we could be living in harmony with this planet. In 2008, 16.5 million new cars sold in America. None of them were electric. Every single one of them burned gasoline. How ridiculous does that sound? In 2009, that amount is down by 35%. Not because we didn't need the cars. It's because you couldn't buy them. Oh, they were available. But the banks necessary to finance the subprime market for those people that don't have $5,000 to put down on a vehicle or don't have credit good enough to extend it out for 7 years couldn't afford a $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 automobile, and so they sat on the lot and they rotted. And the dealers said, oh, please don't ship us any more vehicles. And so the plants shut down one shift and then two shifts. And then the dealerships realized, wait a minute, if they're shutting down shifts, that means the workers are not earning wages, and that means they can't buy our cars. And they destroyed themselves. And if you have any GM stock, hang it on the wall. It makes a nice souvenir because it's worth nothing. So in 2010, guess what? The numbers are going to shift. Some of the cars that sell in 2010 are going to be electric. And in 2011, there will be even more. And hopefully in 2012, we have shifted enough emphasis away from shoveling our planet into our gas tanks and burning it that we managed to walk away from the precipice of self-extinction. Hopefully, there's still time. Anyway, by the time 2011 rolls around, you will be ready for a new car because you couldn't buy one in 2009. And hopefully by the time you're able to buy one in early 2010, you'll take advantage of a little tax rebate of $3,000 or $4,000 or $7,000 to buy an electric vehicle. That's one of the nice things that's happening. The first 100,000 vehicles produced by a new electric car company gets to have a rebate, a little shot in the arm to help the buyer buy the car and allow the electric vehicle company to get a head start. Hopefully they don't end it after 100,000 vehicles. Maybe it'll extend out a little bit more. That way you'll be able to afford to buy it, and the electric car company will be able to afford to build it. All right. Sorry for the cough. Came back from China with it. It will go away. It doesn't have a choice. Phone lines are open tonight. You can call toll-free anywhere in the country of United States or Canada. We have about 11 minutes left, 888-228-4494. And if you have a cell phone, free long distance on nights and weekends. And you can get to cell phone tower, whether you're on planet or off planet, we don't care. 530-776-5154. If you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. Try not to call me directly with Skype because I'm on Skype. This program is coming to you live through the BBS Radio Network, courtesy of Skype. That's why it's so crystal clear, and you can hear it anywhere in the world. Global Radio, right here, free, radio. Those of you that are familiar with the CERN Collider, we have a little bit of news. This week, the 53rd and final replacement magnet for CERN's Large Hadron Collider was lowered into the accelerator's tunnel, marking the end of repair work above ground following the incident of September of last year that brought the LHC operations to a halt. Those of you that thought this was a reprieve from the mini black hole generator, it's now over. So very soon they will be going through the current checks for the CERN Collider, and hopefully they've figured out how to keep these superconductive magnets from crushing themselves when they turn on. The idea behind the collider, if you've been out to see the movie Angels and Demons, you get to see some pretty cool shots of the collider. This collider accelerates heavy ions at one another, sort of like putting two trains on a head-on collision. And they accelerate the particles at close to the speed of light using superconducting magnets to both aim and accelerate the particles. And normally the particles, because they're so small and the odds of a head-on collision are so small, they usually glance off of each other, resulting in very little bit of energy output. However, occasionally they do hit head-on. And when they hit head-on, they annihilate one another, and what we get to see, especially at this level of energy, is we get to see the very first moments of creation as what has been created, or is the result of creation, comes apart. Now, it doesn't take a great carpenter or a great physicist to figure out that looking at something coming apart is not quite exactly like looking at it going together. We might not actually be seeing all the parts of this matter as we smash it apart into its various spectra or components, but we're going to get a good look at the things that make it up. It's sort of like smashing two houses together. You're going to get a lot of splinters and glass and concrete and steel. You're not actually going to see the 2x4s and nails and rolls of fabric that put that house together. But you are going to see the components of it. We see it as various frequencies or photons that come off of the matter as it's smashed together. And some of this information only exists for a billionth of a second. But it is long enough, and we do a mathematical process called fast Fourier transform. Let's see, how can I explain that to you? Let's say you were playing a classical piece of music on the piano. Let's say, Fur Elise. As you're playing the music, you are hitting white keys and black keys, and do you really know how many times you hit that middle C or how many times you hit that F sharp? No, you don't. But a fast Fourier transform would. And what it would do is it would make a spike, a short spike for if you hit the key only a few times, a medium spike if you hit it a few more times, and a very tall spike if you hit that particular key a lot of times. That's what they do with these spectrometers. As these components come apart, they divide up the sensitivities in fractions of a wavelength, and they look at the different photons that come off, and they classify them, and statistically through a mathematical process called a histogram, where they just count up the number of times that photon occurs, and then they get to look at the various strengths of those photons and look at the layout of that wave shape when it's put together. It kind of looks a little bit like a weaving pattern when it comes out. Short spikes for very few occurrences and tall spikes for very high occurrences. But what ends up happening is we end up with signatures. And these Fourier transform signatures tell us what compounds or what atoms or even what subatomic particles were present inside of that piece when it slammed into oblivion. The worry is that they've put enough power into this CERN collider. It's much more powerful than its predecessors. It has a much higher level of control than its predecessors. That they're actually, at least on a subatomic level, able to create tiny black holes. We're going to learn a lot about creation by looking at these tiny black holes. Now, keep in mind, these black holes do not have much matter in them, and so they're not able to attract other matter to them. Even though they're black holes, they're not high gravitational black holes. So please rest easy this week, even though this thing may be creating subatomic black holes, it is not going to suck the Earth into one of them, and you're going to wake up in another universe. That's not going to happen. Just to give you an idea, what's happening in the news with the CERN collider? Here at X Squared Radio, we are sending out our solicitations to fill up June and July with guests for you to hear from. We are going to get the authors of the Roswell incident. We're going to get the authors back on because they've written a new version of their book, a new edited version. We're going to get them back on, see what else they found out. And we really want to know what's going on out there because they probably have the best collection of information about what went on in Roswell than anyone in the world. We feel it's important for you to know, so we're going to be interviewing them. We're also going through a series of books that are rather humorous and insightful, and it's a good look at where religion has taken us over the last couple thousand years and left us sort of at the altar, so to speak, without solutions or a method by which we can find solutions, but have been more or less a fear factory for a long, long time. And we'll get that author on as well. And it's going to be a great year. Don't forget, July 4th weekend. Do not forget, you need to be in Trout Lake, Washington. Buy a bus ticket, hitch a ride, bring your tent, your sleeping bag, and get ready to look at the most amazing activity in the night sky you can imagine. Besides that, you're going to get 3 days of the best speakers and presenters in the genre. It is called the Earth Transformation Conference. You can learn more about it by going to eceti.org, eceti.org. It is inexpensive to get there. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. And also don't forget, in about a week, the H2O Live concerts are occurring somewhere near you. 26 cities. If you want to find out more, click on the H2O Live banner at X Squared Radio. And it's a very inexpensive ticket. Some tickets are as cheap as $15. Why don't you participate in what is being billed as the largest earth healing event in history? And don't forget, every Sunday evening, to tune in live to X Squared Radio. In the case that you don't get all 3 hours or you don't get the program live, don't worry about it, because you can listen to it in several different places. One, you can go to bbsradio.com, click on the X Squared Radio archives and listen there. You can go to X Squared Radio and click on the archives there and subscribe. And if you're a listener on the Conscious Media Network, we welcome you. And don't forget, when you finish listening to X Squared Radio, make your way back to bbsradio.com. That's where the action is. The best hosts in the business. And remember, we're thinking of you all the time. So if you want to send us a note, send us a suggestion, click on the Suggest a Guest link at X Squared Radio and let us know. We'll investigate. We'll go take pictures if that's what it takes. And we've got a lot of great stuff for you coming the rest of the year. We love you. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.
Your problem?
Picking up transmission from Mars.
You're listening to BBS Radio. An internet radio experience of truth, harmony, beauty. From your family at BBS Radio, have yourself a beautiful day.
Rocks. You're listening to BBS Radio,
the number one internet radio network on the planet.
That's bbsradio.com.
Hi, this is singer-songwriter Cara Johnstad, and you're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.